This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll have the attorney for the American student who was tortured in Saudi Arabia, falsely confessed, and brought back to the United States, recently convicted on the basis of those torture-induced confessions.
How could the jury have believed this man's confession after he was tortured in Saudi Arabia?
We'll also have Chesa Boudin, activist and editor of the recently released book, Letters from Young Activists.
If you're wondering what happened to the student and young people's movement, don't worry anymore and don't wonder. Read Chase's book.
Paul Chevenier, longtime lawyer on the case, will tell us about the police claim to unrestricted photo surveillance of demonstrators and the challenge that we're facing in court.
We thought we had won this one. We thought we'd stop the cops from photographing us at demos.
Famed enemy combatant Jose Padilla has been in jail 3.5 years without charges. Recently, the government switched it up. We'll have his attorney, Andy Patel, here to tell us exactly what the government's up to this time around.
What characterizes this administration is arbitrary justice.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. I'd like to welcome Chesa Boudin. Nation Books has published Letters from Young Activists. Chesa wrote the first piece and was one of the three editors. It's also edited by Dan Berger and Kenyon Farrow. Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out. Chesa Boudin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back.
It's nice to have you back. I want to read the dedication of this book and then ask you about how you came to help put this collection together. The book is dedicated for young people everywhere who struggle for peace, justice, and liberation, for the movements of yesterday, today, and tomorrow that act with the promise of a better world. Chesa, how'd you come to think that this kind of book was necessary and get the people to contribute to it?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I've been active in progressive organizing and politics for pretty much my whole life, and I grew up in a very political family, and a lot of the people who I've worked with have felt that, and I've experienced this myself, that young people in the United States are marginalized. And to the extent that we are included in sort of public discourse about politics, we tend to be presented as either kind of crazy black-clad anarchists or moderate liberal do-gooders, and there's a bit of a false dichotomy. I think the young people who are engaged in political organizing are much more diverse than that, are the people who are going to inherit tomorrow. I think we need to give young people a voice in talking about the political issues of today, and that's the main goal for this book, to create a platform in which young people who are thinking about political issues can define themselves.
You say that you were lucky yourself to grow up in a political family, in a really unique political family, I would add, from reading your first piece in the book. Tell us a bit about the family you grew up in.
I was born into a family that had been politically active for really several generations, actually. But my biological parents were arrested when I was 14 months old for their role in the 1981 Brinks robbery, which was a robbery carried out by the Black Liberation Army. My dad was sentenced to 75 years to life and my mother to 20 years to life. So the letter that I write in this book is a letter to my father. And what I try to do in it is to reflect a little bit on the benefits I've had growing up in such a politically conscious family, but also the difficulties that came along with having parents in prison and with the legacy that I inherited from my father in terms of the crime he committed and the mistakes that he and his generation of activists made.
What kind of mistakes would you caution us not to make? What have you learned from your long relationship with David Gilbert, your biological father, someone who all of us, you know, very much admire and respect?
Well, thank you. I have a wonderful relationship with my father, but I think one of the maybe major issues that I'd say first comes to mind is the issue of armed struggle and the extent that violence can or should play in a political process or a movement for social change. Obviously, in the case of my parents' crime, they were involved in a violent action, and although nobody was intended to get hurt, the result was that three people did get killed, two police officers and a security guard. So that's a very real human cost that came along with their political work, and it's something that I've had, you know, had to think about and talk to them about and deal with my entire life as a result. So I think it's made me think a lot about how and if and when violence is ever justified as a form of social change.
Well, with respect to Venezuela, I know you've spent a lot of time there and you've seen the whole revolutionary process down there unfold. You write in the book that the people down there who you look to are for a democratic, peaceful, revolutionary process, but they will defend themselves by any means necessary if they have to.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an important point, and I actually talk about a bit about Venezuela in my letter in this book, Letters from Young Activists. In Venezuela, the political process underway is democratic in that it's been ratified by popular vote. The people leading the political changes have been elected. It's revolutionary in that they're dramatically reworking and reinventing the political process and the extent to which poor people actually have a say in the policies that get put in place and in accessing the oil wealth that the country has. But people are very conscious of the fact that the United States government is hostile to the interests of the Venezuelan government, that Colombian paramilitary groups are a potential threat just over the border from Venezuela. And so what Venezuelan young activists I talked to and people in the government as well have made clear, what Chavez made clear in the book of interviews that I translated with Monthly Review Press, is that they want to be peaceful, but they're willing to defend the revolution by any means necessary. And it's been in the news a lot lately. You see the recent acquisition of mainly defensive coastal patrol boats that they just bought from Spain in a billion-plus dollar deal, some light arms and rifles that they bought from Russia back in December of last year. The Chavez administration has been moving to acquire defensive weapons as a way of defending and discouraging any potential incursion from paramilitary groups in Colombia or even, as he talks about quite often, from the U.S. government.
We're here on Law and Disorder with Chesa Boudin, who's edited this wonderful new book, just came out last week, Nation Books, Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out. Chesa, give us a little bit of an overview of what's in the book and what sort of people contributed to. I know there's one person's 10 years old, another's 30. I think it's the range between then. These people seem to be involved in every aspect of the movement here in this country. Tell us about who these people are and what sort of contributions they've made.
Well, like any successful protest or organizing, we as a group are much more powerful than we are as individuals. When we speak alone. And so one of our goals as editors of the book was to bring together as broad and as diverse a group of young people who are involved in progressive political organizing as possible and to try to bring together their experiences and their backgrounds into one cohesive piece, essentially. So what we have here is about 48 separate letters, and we chose letters because we felt that they'd be much more accessible to the reader, more personal, but also more accessible to potential contributors. Obviously, not all activists and not all organizers have an advanced degree or higher education, and we wanted to make sure there was a level playing field for all organizers who be able to write something that would be accessible to a broad range of readers as well. So we have, as I said, 48 letters from people around the United States, wide range of backgrounds and ethnicities and religions, and also a wide range of political perspectives and political activities that they're involved in.
This is Michael Ratner speaking, and I really want to thank Chesa for being here with this book. It came in the mail to my house a week or two ago, and I picked it up that night, and I just couldn't put it down. It's fantastic. It's a real insight into what young people are thinking, and it gives you great hope for the future. And your essay in particular, I appreciated, because I think while there was a lot going on, obviously, with you and your parents, you talked about that in the beginning, but you said, look, there's no point to just beating this to death. Let's go on to what's been positive about our lives. And I just was extremely moved by your essay as well as the others. It's just a book I really recommend to people. It's particularly for people of our generation in the 60s or 70s who just are not that familiar with what's going on right now.
Well, what are some of your favorite letters in the book?
You know, there's so many that I love. One of the great things about being editor for the book was that I got to meet dozens of young people around the United States who are doing great work, and many of them were people I'd never met before. So it was a really wonderful experience, and I learned a lot from working with them. One of my favorite letters is actually from somebody who I worked with when I was an undergraduate, and I asked her to contribute to this book because I thought she was a great writer, and I really respected her work as an organizer. I'd worked with her, and even though I was a senior, and when she was a freshman at my undergraduate university, she actually took over groups that I hadn't been able to do anything with and really led them, and they're doing great things now. And her name is Sarah Stillman, and she wrote...
Would you be able to read part of that?
Of her letter?
Yeah, yeah. What?
Sure, yeah. Let me just flip to it here. She now a senior at Yale University, and she's done a lot of writing from the time she was very, very little. Does a lot of really important research on globalization and sweatshops.
Chase, so while you're looking, I'm curious, did the other two editors and you actively seek out individuals? Or did you put out a call for articles, for the letters?
A bit of both. There was actually a three-tiered selection process. We started by asking people we knew and had worked with. In my case, I talked to Sarah, among other people. And we got about maybe 25 submissions from that round. But we wanted a lot more than that. And so then we built a website and we put emails out over all the different activist listservs that we had access to. And we got maybe another 60 or 70 submissions from that. And then once we had around 100 submissions, we started putting together a manuscript. Once we had a first draft manuscript, we had asked a group of four older women of color activists to be an advisory board to us. It's an all-male editorial board. We wanted to make sure that that didn't affect the quality of the editing. And so we had a group of older women of color who have been really involved in a range of social movements going back to the 50s and 60s take a look at our first draft manuscript and then make suggestions about what kind of gaps in content and diversity there were. And then with their help, we went out and actually did a third round of targeted solicitation to people to try to fill those holes. Of course, there are still holes. We had space limitations, and there's no way to make everything work. But so one of my favorites, and you know, there's so many, it's hard to pick just one, but one of the ones that I really enjoyed is by a young woman. She's actually the youngest contributor in the book. She's 10 years old. She's from Gainesville, Florida. And her name is Chloe Joy. And I'll read you her letter. It's very short. Hey, kids, some grown-ups just don't get it. They act like we're still babies when we're seven or something. They like to touch us too much and pinch our cheeks or pat our heads. And they act like we don't know anything. I'm a big kid who knows stuff. And I want to be treated like a person, not a baby. I think grown-ups should listen to me. I'm smart. I know a lot. I will not tolerate being treated like a baby. I spent my whole life hanging around my mom and her friends. I've been on marches, always had my own sign, too. I've been to the Southern Girls Convention. I worked to make my school recognize Women's History Month when they were going to ignore it. I know how unions work, and I think kids need one. First, I think all kids should read Click Clack Moo, Cows That Type, by Doreen Cronin and Betsy Lewin. This book tells all about union organizing. A bunch of cows get together and use an old typewriter to demand electric blankets. Duck is the neutral party. He takes the letters back and forth between the farmer and the animals. The cows get tired of letters, and they go on strike. The chickens strike too, and the animals win. When animals stick together, they get what they want. So I think kids should stick together and try to get what we want. Here are some good demands. 1. Stop treating us like babies. This should stop at 4 years old. Or maybe it should never happen. 2. Spend more time with us. You're always too busy. Try harder to take a little time off for us. 3. We should have a say in things our families do. Sorry, I can't think of any more, but that's a good start. Kids unite. Chloe.
Oh my God, great.
That's great.
Beautiful.
This is Michael Smith here with Law and Disorder. We're interviewing Chase Aboudin, the editor of a new book, Letters from Activists. And Chase, Bernardine Dorn wrote a really beautiful, poetic preface to the book. And I wonder whether you could read a couple of paragraphs out of it for us.
Sure. Yeah, it was an honor to have her, obviously, as a mother as well as a contributor to write the preface to this book. And I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs, and then people can check out the book if they want to read the rest. It's also available on Monthly Review Press's online magazine, Monthly Review, that we wanted to make available to the public that people can also read for free online.
We'll put a link to it up on lawanddisorder.org.
Great. Thank you. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs here from the preface by Bernardine Dorn. Under the subheading Imagination and Hope. Being a revolutionary, a radical, an anarchist, a rebel, requires imagination, now more than ever. Today, the United States constitutes 4.8% of the world's population, yet controls 60% of the world's wealth, and 1% of the world's richest receive as much income as 57% of the world's poorest. As Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez likes to note, if the rest of the world consumed oil at the current rate of the U.S., all the oil and oil reserves would be depleted in some 19 days, an ongoing ecological disaster that cannot last. This inequitable and unjust situation can only be sustained by naked force, domination of resources, media, finance, culture, and critically, the sense that there is no other way, that global U.S.-dominated neoliberal capitalism is inevitable and unending. The savage U.S. war and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, the permanent war against terrorism, the militarization of economy, culture, and institutions, and the consequent erosion of democracy, transparency, and liberty at home are normalized, presented as a given, a natural phenomenon. The very notion that we will go along, collude, itself requires us to respond with urgency. 5 years ago, the U.S. spent as much on its military as the next 15 countries combined. Today, the U.S. spends as much as all other countries combined. To stand against this plunder in the face of the drumbeat of such overwhelming certainty that what you do won't make a difference requires a radical leap of audacity, of imagination. It is essential to the project of empire that people cannot imagine another way, that the inevitability of people's powerlessness is overwhelming.
Thank you, Chesa. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us. Chesa Boudin, the editor of the new book, Letters from Young Activists. If you would like to listen to young Chloe Joy's letter once again, or hear Chesa read his own letter or others, please log on to lawanddisorder.org. Listeners will remember that several months ago, we covered the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, an American who went to Saudi Arabia as a foreign exchange student and found himself in Saudi custody, tortured and beaten, forced into confessing that he intended to hurt President Bush. He was brought back here to the United States and put on trial on the basis of those torture-induced confessions. With us, we have his attorney, Hurrem Wahid. Hurrem is a former public defender. He was with the Neighborhood Defender Services of Harlem, like our co-host Michael Stephen Smith. And he is now with Wahid and Viscano. He took the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali and unfortunately suffered a defeat last week. Abu Ali was convicted of 9 counts of aiding al-Qaeda and plotting terrorist acts. He was accused of being part of a conspiracy, basically, to kill President Bush through some ridiculous plots like driving a car and shooting him from the sidewalk and planning other terrorist acts. Hurrem Wahid of Wahid and Viscano, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
This jury decision just destroyed me.
Yeah, me too, as with my partners. And, of course, you know, I saw it on the faces of many of the community members who, I have to thank, who came out day after day after day for 2 full months.
Well, Hurrem, tell us, what's at the heart of this decision, and why is this such a blow, the defeat?
Well, this is the first case ever where the United States government relied solely upon evidence collected by a foreign government to conduct a prosecution of an American citizen here in the United States. The evidence in this case was solely confessions of Mr. Abu Ali, and Ahmed made about 33 pages of written statements over 47 nights where he was kept in solitary confinement. He was not allowed an attorney, not allowed to see a judge, not allowed to talk to his family, not allowed to speak to the consular officer. And this all comes after he was whipped on his back repeatedly until he agreed to make a confession.
For listeners who are unfamiliar, we covered this story several months back, but for listeners who are unfamiliar, tell us about the case. Tell us about Ahmed Omar Abu Ali and what happened to him.
In 2002, in September of 2002, he went overseas. He went to Medina to do a study abroad program at the University of Medina and to learn Islamic law. He was there, and somewhere around late May or mid-May of 2003, there were these explosions in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. There was a massive roundup after that, very similar to what we saw here after September 11th, where they literally just went out and picked up hundreds and hundreds of young Arab men, and mostly from the universities, who they felt they were political activists, and this was an act against the monarchy, so they were going after people who they felt were politically outspoken against the government. But, you know, as in any roundup, they just grab everybody who's standing next to them. So they put him in custody in Medina jail. The group is called the Mabahith. They're the Saudi secret police, pretty much a very clandestine local or domestic police agency, kind of the KGB of Saudi Arabia. They put him in custody. The first day, he wouldn't speak to them. He said he wants a lawyer. He said he knows his rights. He's an American. To see the consular officer. They said, no, you're in Saudi Arabia. You don't get that. You'll get to see everyone you want after you confess. By the second day, they were tired of his so-called stonewalling, as they say, and they decided to just take action. So they chained him to the ground and whipped him repeatedly on his back, first with his shirt on, then they tore his shirt off, and they continued to whip him. He doesn't know exactly how many times. He doesn't know what the object, because he was blindfolded during the process, but he was told to confess, until he finally said, stop, and I'll say whatever you want.
Is that typical of Saudi interrogations?
You know, there's a job in Saudi Arabia. The English translation of it is the whipper. There's a job where that's his job, to do that sort of thing, to whip people. They claim it's only on the punishment phase, but there is a long line of complaints against the Saudi government, and it's in our own United States State Department country report that they use this to coerce confessions. By their own admission, the Saudis say we have a 100% confession rate. Well, if they get that simply through serving tea and honey, I would wonder why we're not doing it here.
Now, Karim, as I remember, the center was involved, the Center for Constitutional Rights, briefly, and I think you'll go into that, that once he was in Saudi custody for a while, there was a habeas corpus petition filed in the American courts that essentially won. And at that point, the allegation being that he was actually put into Saudi custody by the U.S. or at the behest of the U.S., and they were essentially monitoring this. Is that what you think happened here?
I do. I think there was a combination of things. There is evidence that we presented during the motion to suppress, and the argument we were making was a joint venture argument, essentially saying that the United States government was using the Saudis as their agents in a completely intertwined joint venture to investigate this young man. The evidence showed, and there were emails that we introduced that showed communications between the Saudi Mabahith and the Washington field office of the FBI regarding Mr. Abu Ali, that not only started after his arrest, but showed dates prior to his arrest, which indicates that there was communication between them regarding Mr. Abu Ali prior to his arrest. I believe there was evidence it was a joint venture.
Right. What makes me really think that, of course, is once the writ of habeas corpus was granted, a judge in Washington said, you have a right to discovery. Yeah. We think that there may be, that the U.S. may be involved here and in charge of his detention, actually, in a certain way. Then, it was only then that the U.S. indicted the guy and brought him here to the United States, which means to me that they've been essentially in control of this guy for the whole period.
I think another good point to bring up regarding the habeas is that until the habeas was filed, there really didn't seem to be any interest in prosecuting Mr. Abu Ali. He was sitting and languishing in a Saudi jail, and I think the United States at that point had no real interest in him because they didn't take these claims of assassinating the president or freeing the Guantanamo detainees seriously, as they shouldn't. Once they felt, oh, he's going to be coming back, now we have to figure out what to do with him, that's when they sprung into action and began recording the conversations through a FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrant, between his family and him whenever he would call home. That's when they began really getting serious about it and putting together a case on Mr. Abu Ali.
Karim, you just mentioned briefly some of the alleged confessions that Ahmed Omar Abu Ali made. Can you describe the extent of those and how they were admissible in court?
Yeah, there were 33 English handwritten pages that are called the interrogation logs. The Saudis every night would bring him to the interrogation room. You'd be brought there, cuffed, blindfolded, shackled into the room. They would take off all the cuffs, the blindfolds, and they would say, look, you know, you have, this can be easy or this can be hard. And they would go through a process of telling him what the other people they had in custody were saying the plots were about. And they would say, this is what happened, right? And he would say, no, I don't know anything about it. And over the course of the whole night, 5, 6, sometimes 7 hours through the night, starting 9, 10 at night, going through the dawn, by the end of it, he agreed to write down whatever they told him. He wrote it in his own handwriting, and he affixed a thumbprint to it. And that went on for 47 nights. At the end of that period of time, they also had him do a summary confession, which is a one-document summary, 10 pages long, that the Mabayev admit they wrote themselves. They wrote it, and they told him to sign it. Then they had him read that, and that became a videotaped confession. The videotaped confession happened on July 24th of 2003. He was arrested on June 8th of 2003, and he was whipped on June 9th of 2003. So this videotaped confession was after over 45 days in custody. He was told, if you finish this, you're done. We'll get you out of solitary, and finally, you may even get home.
This is Michael Smith. I want to just remind our listeners tuned in that we have Karum Wahid on Law and Disorder, and we're talking about a case of an American citizen tortured in Saudi Arabia, and then his confession was used to frame him up and convict him here in the United States just recently. How do you get a handle on this? What's your explanation for why a United States court and jury would convict somebody under these circumstances? How do you explain it?
Do they not buy the torture?
Yeah, I think that you're going to hear, and I know that there's some articles being written by reporters who spoke to jurors, you're going to hear that the jury is going to say they didn't believe the torture. I think the evidence was overwhelming.
What was the evidence?
Overwhelming. There were whip marks on his back, marks that every doctor, including the government doctors, admit are from external trauma. The difference was, what was the source of the trauma? Every doctor admits that each mark is about the same width, which means it's from the same object. They're random on his back. And we had his own personal doctor, his family physician, come in and say those marks weren't there before he went to Saudi Arabia. There's no question that I think we proved that there was some force used on his back while he was there in Saudi Arabia.
So then what's going on? Why wouldn't the jury buy it?
You know, it's one of these things where if, and this is my speculation, obviously, but if I'm sitting there on the jury and I hear all of these so-called plots against Americans, and I hear the closing argument of the prosecutor who says, this man came here to kill you. This man came here to destroy America. He's one of your own, and he's your worst nightmare because you will never know it.
That was the closing?
That was the closing. Yeah. You know, this is another 9/11 about to happen, and we caught it before it did.
Attorney Karum Wahid, a couple of us here on the program were actually in the courthouse when Lynn Stewart was convicted of conspiracy to aid terrorism here in the United States. Prosecutor summed up the same fashion that you just outlined. They scared the pants off the jury.
We had another case out in Brooklyn. A guy just got 75 years. Again, they dragged in everything from Osama bin Laden to everything else.
Yeah.
And what I see going on across the...
Yeah, I know the case well.
And what's going on across the country right now is you bring that stuff in, juries are convicting. It's incredible.
Karum Wahid, I have another question for you. Tell us about this kid. He's 24 years old. What is he looking at?
Well, he's looking at any number of years up to life.
20 to life?
Well, no, it could be any number of years. There's no mandatory minimum, believe it or not, on the assassination of the president charge when it's an attempt. You didn't actually carry it out. It's only a conspiracy charge. And quite frankly, you know, we're going to fight. We're going to do our best to keep the numbers as low as possible. But I think there's a lot of pressure on the court here to give life. I wouldn't be shocked if that's what happened.
Shocking case, really shocking. But, you know, unfortunately, it reflects similar cases. So.
It really does. And Karum Wahid, we will be watching developments in this case and the other ones that you've been involved in. Listeners can log on to lawanddisorder.org to listen to discussion of this case some months back and to send in your comments about this case. Karum Wahid of Wahid and Viscano, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
I appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
You know, I was talking to Karum after the verdict came in. He had told me that this defendant, Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, he said he felt incredibly humiliated by the entire trial. He said it was the most degrading thing he'd ever been through in his entire life.
Well, Abu Ali said that.
Yeah, and he's having to be stripped down frequently to being called a terrorist and that he wanted to do these horrible things and he's just a normal kid. Mm. And so he said, you know, if I can't take any more humiliation, and if they come back and convict me, I don't want to show how hurt I am. on the day the jury came back, Hurrem was sitting next to Ahmed, and he said, as they came in, he leaned over and he whispered to him, "They're not looking at us."
Meaning that's a bad sign.
Yeah, sure. Well, they said, "Sorry. They're not looking at us." Ahmed looked at him and goes, "That's a bad sign, isn't it?" And he said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "Okay, I'm going to be strong."
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart I have but one desire, and that one is you. No other will do. I've lost all ambition for worldly acclaim. I just want to be the one you love. And with your admission that you feel the same, I'll have reached the goal I'm dreaming of. Believe me, I don't want to set the world on fire.
We're pleased to have on Andy Patel, who is the lawyer for Jose Padilla. And I say Padilla because that is the way his name is pronounced, Jose Padilla. You all may remember him. He's the so-called, or was the so-called enemy combatant that was held for 3.5 years without charges, the so-called dirty bomber, American citizen, got off a plane in Chicago, picked up, thrown into a brig, 3.5 years. Today we have with us, as I said, Andy Patel, who is Jose Padilla's lawyer. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
So there's been some recent amazing developments in his case, I think, to all of us. Can you just tell us a little bit of the background first and then what happened recently?
Well, the background is pretty straightforward. May 8th, 2002, Mr. Padilla stepped off a plane in Chicago. He was met by FBI agents who eventually executed a material witness warrant that had been issued by a federal judge here in New York.
Oh, I forgot. He was first held as a material witness, right?
That's right. He was brought to New York. He was assigned an attorney, regular criminal process. On June 9th, 2002, President Bush signed an order declaring him to be a, quote, enemy combatant, unquote, and he was transferred from the Department of Justice to the Department of Defense. He has been housed in the brig in just outside of Charleston, South Carolina. This week, the president issued an order undoing his June 9th order, essentially, and transferring him from the Department of Defense to the Department of Justice. An indictment was unsealed. He has been charged as part of a case that has been pending in the Southern District of Florida in Miami for about a year now, on charges completely and totally unrelated to anything we've heard about him before.
Well, one fact I wanted to bring out here is in the last couple of years, there's been some litigation, and there's litigation that's still going on that you guys were going to the Supreme Court or something or getting ready to go to the Supreme Court.
Initially, there was litigation in the district court here in New York where the judge found that the president had the authority to hold an American citizen as an enemy combatant, but that there had to be a hearing where the government would have to establish that that was in fact true. The government appealed that decision to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The Second Circuit found that the president did not have that authority. It said that he either had to be charged or released or held as a material witness again. The government appealed that decision to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court did not reach the merits of the case.
Right. I remember that. They just dismissed on saying you guys filed in the wrong court.
Right. They said we should have started this whole process down in South Carolina.
So you started over again.
We started all over again, and we went before Judge Henry Floyd, the United States District Court for South Carolina. Judge Floyd, like the Second Circuit, found that the president had no authority to do this. The government appealed to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that the president does have the authority to hold an American citizen arrested on American soil as a so-called enemy combatant without criminal charges. And we have filed a petition asking the court, the Supreme Court, to review that. The government's reply was due, well, actually yesterday, this past Monday. I got a call from the Solicitor General's office saying that an indictment had been unsealed. Would we consent to an application to the Fourth Circuit to transfer Mr. Padilla from military custody to civilian custody? The answer to that question was obviously yes. This week, the Fourth Circuit issued an order asking for additional briefing, and that's where things stand right now.
You know, what's happened, I think, has caused quite a storm, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is, of course, it kept the guy for 3.5 years without any charges, and when they go charge him, they don't charge him with anything that they originally alleged, right? They originally alleged dirty bomb, and then it went down to gas and blowing up an apartment. And does the new indictment have anything about this, or the indictment, the first indictment?
No. The indictment is really charges more material support and nothing to do with anything about attacks within the United States.
So what do we think happened to the other charges?
Oh, you know, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I take them as they come. I prefer not to speculate about what happened, why they did what they did. I am very happy to be out from behind the looking glass and, you know.
One of the speculations, at least in the newspaper, was that there was the results of torture of other people overseas claim that somehow this is what got Padilla on this.
The effect they put this to, they scared the pants off of everybody in this country when they said the guy was the dirty bomber, you know, that he's going to bring in some kind of uranium or something that's going to kill 200 million people, and that they had to clamp him away and that they couldn't allow access to attorneys or his family or anybody like that. They essentially threw habeas corpus out the window, law that goes back to the year 1215. It was a law that humanity had evolved, and it's a law that the Bush administration is trashing.
In 2002, this guy is picked up on a material witness warrant, already an abuse of power from the very beginning. Then he's transferred and he becomes a so-called enemy combatant. And for years, people are saying, listen, release or charge, release or charge. So finally, we're looking, you got a deadline coming up in the Supreme Court. And the administration, again, once again, moves his status. And they lodge criminal charges against him, and he moves to the Department of Justice. And this is a pattern that we've seen repeatedly in the war on terror, in moving detainees, moving places, whether it's rendering them, taking them out of the United States and rendering them to another secret location where they can be tortured and questioned, or changing their status here at home. We're seeing the administration doing everything to evade the law. What do you make of this?
Well, I think one of my favorite examples of that is what happened to Mr. Hamdi. Mr. Hamdi was an American citizen who was captured in Afghanistan, or more accurately, purchased in Afghanistan. A bounty was paid for him, and he came into American custody. He was initially brought to Guantanamo, but under the president's order of, I believe it's November 11th, 2001. Thank
right.
you. That order precludes American citizens from being sent to Guantanamo. He was found to actually be an American citizen and was transferred initially to a brig in Norfolk, Virginia, and then to the same place where Mr. Padilla has been. The government at one point filed an affidavit saying that he was too dangerous to be allowed to speak with or meet with an attorney. After the Supreme Court said, this guy's entitled to some kind of hearing, and of course he's entitled to counsel, the government sent him home. The concept under which he was sent home was the concept of military parole. And military parole goes back to like the Napoleonic era and the code of chivalry, where you as a officer and a gentleman would give your word if you were released that you would not take up arms against whoever it was that released you. Mr. Hamdi, the same gentleman who a year or so earlier had been too dangerous to meet with an attorney, was released because he gave his word of honor that he would not be a terrorist again.
Wasn't too dangerous at that point to meet with CNN in Saudi.
I mean, they just sent him home.
No, it's another example. As soon as the government's power is really going to be tested with any of these guys, whether it's Hamdi or now Padilla, which I think the Supreme Court would not have said that you could hold a U.S. citizen picked up in the United States as an enemy combatant.
We had negotiated a briefing schedule, and the government's reply brief was due on a whatever day it was due at 3 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, I was sitting in my office. I got a call from a lieutenant colonel who said, we've decided to give you access to your client. Call Captain so-and-so at Joint Forces Command. And by the way, Captain so-and-so is in the Navy, which means he's equivalent of a full colonel. And you guys can work out the details. At 2 o'clock, the government had a press conference saying that they were giving Mr. Padilla access to counsel. At 3 o'clock, they filed their reply brief on the cert request saying to the Supreme Court that they did not need to take the due process issue because it was moot because they were giving Padilla access to his lawyer. And they cited to the web link of their press conference 1 hour before their briefing.
Unbelievable.
Amazing.
No respect for law. It's right. It's complete disrespect
they
for
don't
law.
Want review.
It's a child's view of the law. I get to do what I want to do, and I'll make it happen the way I want to.
It's been an interesting few years.
So where is Mr. Padilla in prison now?
South Carolina.
He's still there?
He is still there pending a decision, signing of the order by the Fourth Circuit.
Because even though the president said transfer him, the Fourth Circuit has held up the transfer from military custody to the Department of Justice. Right,
to civilian custody.
They've held that up.
That's right. They've asked for some additional briefing
on that issue.
In an order.
You know, Andy, I think we should mention that he converted to be a Muslim, that even though his name sounds like a Spanish name, he's not. And I think that's why he fell into their sights.
He's still Latino, but he's
that's correct.
Latino
I mean,
he's
certainly yeah. His family has got clear Latin roots.
Andy, what does this say about the ability of the administration to hold someone as an enemy combatant in the United States? I mean, we still have the Almari case, the case of the non-U.S. citizen who's still being held as an enemy combatant. But what does this say about not only that case, but about the administration holding U.S. citizens as enemy combatants?
Well, there's nothing that's happened that has caused the administration to say, we do not have the authority to do this.
Even the Supreme Court case in Hamdi.
Even in Hamdi. In fact, they would argue that Hamdi says, well, it's fine for them to do this.
In fact, Hamdi, actually, if you look at Hamdi, which was a man picked up, as Andy said, for money in Afghanistan, American citizen, what the Supreme Court said is that four of the justices accepted the government's view of that you could hold an enemy combatant, but with a very narrow definition. Someone picked up in Afghanistan or basically in a war against the United States who actually picks up arms against the United States. The U.S. government has a much broader view of what's an enemy combatant, or the Bush administration does. It includes all these kind of people, whether it's Almari or Padilla or others. So that has never been supported by the Supreme Court yet. It's this narrower definition that has.
The government's definition of what an enemy combatant is disconcertingly broad.
Well, we want to thank you, Andy, for coming with us, and good luck with Mr. Padilla's case. You've been listening to Andy Patel, a lawyer for Mr. Jose Padilla, who was an enemy combatant and has now been indicted on a conspiracy in a court in Florida.
And Andy, thank you so much for all your work that you've done.
Thank you.
It's been
thank
an amazing ride, twice to the Supreme Court, or almost twice, mm-hmm. And now back to Florida.
Earlier in the show, we interviewed a lawyer for Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber. Let's have a look now at the reality of the dirty bomb scare. With us is Dr. Thomas Cochran, a physicist at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Dr. Cochran, can you first tell our listeners exactly what is a dirty bomb?
A dirty bomb would be a source of radioactivity which is dispersed using chemical explosives such as dynamite or some high-explosive material.
And what kind of damage would a dirty bomb do if it was dispersed?
Depends on how much radioactivity would be involved. Problem with dirty bombs as a terrorist weapon is that small amounts of radioactivity won't do much damage, and in fact, most of the damage would be from the high-explosive itself. As you increase the amount of radioactivity and the variety of isotopes that would be commercially available, you start to run into a problem. You need to shield these sources to protect yourself in transporting the materials. by the time you get to a large enough source to do have some serious consequences, you're talking about a fair amount of shielding.
The Jose Padilla case, we just had his attorney on, and you know the charges against him for carrying a dirty bomb have just magically been dropped. And we're all very suspicious of this. And what was your reaction when the government dropped the charges? My own reaction was, that it was an impossible thing to do to begin with, and it was all hype and scared people. What was your reaction to it?
I would say, in terms of doing some serious damage, a terrorist, if one were going to try to do some serious damage, would more likely involve a scenario where you went to a fixed source and tried to blow up some fixed source somewhere. Depending on the size of the source, the shielding could be quite heavy, and at the high end, you'd need a forklift to move this material around. It's certainly not something you would sort of strap on your back like your bombs going off.
Or bring on and carry on luggage coming back from Pakistan.
No, you wouldn't.
Dr. Cochran from the Natural Resources Defense Council, thanks so much for bringing the scientific, very interesting angle to this.
Quite well.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Yeah, goodbye.
Bye.
We rely on our law to govern our operations. The United States does not permit, tolerate, or condone torture under any circumstances. Moreover, in accordance with the policy of this administration, the United States has respected and will continue to respect the sovereignty of other countries. The United States does not transport and has not transported detainees from one country to another for the purpose of interrogation using torture.
That was Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice at a press conference from her European tour that focused on U.S. torture and abuse. Rice's visit drew protests all across Europe. The story deepened last week with reports of a revealed U.S. Defense Department memo that proves an explicit policy of rendition for torture. Last week, a group of 25 U.S. Christians called Witness Against Torture illegally entered Cuba and embarked on a 4 to 5 day hike intent on arriving at the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo to visit the prisoners. They're on the doorstep of the base. In June of this year, President Bush said to those concerned with the conditions in Guantanamo, "You're welcome to go down yourself and take a look at the conditions." Now this group of U.S. Christians is calling Bush's bluff. After 3 days of marching under the hot Caribbean sun, the U.S. Christian group is just a few miles from the base. We go now to hear excerpts from a Witness Against Torture press conference held last week. Among the speakers are the Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Gita Gutierrez and CCR President and Law and Disorder co-host Michael Ratner.
I'm going to start with Mike McGuire from Witness Against Torture Group.
Mike McGuire from Baltimore. Been working, helping organize the march since we started organizing this in the spring. I'm going to read the statement from the group and some of the personal statements from folks that are on the march. The detention center at the United States Naval Base in Guantanamo, Cuba, was made for the purposes of secrecy, unaccountability, and impunity. The few reports that do reach us tell of prisoners, men who are fathers, sons, and brothers, without contact with their families, with very little or no contact with attorneys, of interminable detention without legal charge, of rendition, of kidnapping, and the sale of prisoners to U.S. authorities, of the description of the desecration of the Quran, and of unconscionable prisoner humiliation and abuse. These reports have put the base, with its counterpart in Iraq, Abu Ghraib prison, at the center of serious charges of U.S. torture. Despite U.S. government and media attempts to hide it, there is every reason to believe that such horrific practices are routine there and in other facilities around the world. We hear the cry of the prisoners when we read of the hunger strikes and are compelled to do what little we can. To answer, you are not forgotten. We come so far to visit the prisoners to do a work of mercy because the very existence of the detention camps at Guantanamo Bay defies a coherent ethical explanation. Putting detention camps at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base is an effort to hide both the prisoners and the inhuman and illegal practices allowed and enforced from ordinary Americans like ourselves. In our name and in the name of the war on terrorism, the U.S. government is committing immoral and illegal acts mocking and ignoring international law, all at a place that is illegal for us to even visit. This secrecy, this silence cannot go on. We hold the treatment of prisoners, especially those like Muhammad, as a mirror to our own societal soul. As long as some of us are degraded, all of us are. As long as some of us are chained, none of us are free.
The next speakers, who are from the Center for Constitutional Rights, the group that has done remarkable work and won the Supreme Court ruling that said that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have a right to a trial outside of the U.S. military courts in a United States federal courthouse. So I guess we could start with their attorney, Ms. Gutierrez.
Thank you. And I want to stand here in solidarity today with the people of faith who are going to Guantanamo to witness what is happening there. There are over 500 men imprisoned in Guantanamo, and they've been there for nearly 4 years. They have been held virtually incommunicado. And by that, I mean that for these 4 years, they have received letters or news from the outside world or from their family once every 6 months at best. They've had no contact with the outside world other than military interrogators from the United States and many other countries. In Guantanamo, a hunger strike has been going on since August 8th, and this is perhaps the most profound example of the human impact of the illegal policies in Guantanamo. Men in Guantanamo have not eaten since August 8th. There are a group of men who are subjected right now to force feeding simply to keep them alive. And those men are doing so because they have been removed outside the rule of law. They have been removed outside a sense of humanity and have been subjected to conditions in which they would rather die. It is astounding to me that men in the custody of the United States military would rather die than stay in custody. And I am so grateful and appreciative and have so much respect for the individuals who are going down to Guantanamo to resist and protest and witness what is happening. It is desperately needed. And I give them, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, give them all of our support and are grateful for their efforts on behalf of the men in Guantanamo as well as their families.
Thank you. And Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thank you, and I was really glad Gita got to speak. Gita is, as you can probably tell, is somewhat younger than I am, and has had the incredible courage of going down and meeting with people in Guantanamo. I did that last in the 90s when we had the Haitian refugees there, and she's played just an amazing, amazing role. When the people from the Catholic Worker came to me and they said, "We're thinking about doing this," you know, my first reaction was, "What are you guys? You out of your minds?" You know, we represent some 400 people right now who have been trapped by our government for, quote, illegally going to Cuba. And I said, you know, how are you going to do this? I've been to that place. This is the remote desert kingdom of the United States. I mean, this idea just seemed to me far-fetched, fanciful. How is this going to happen? And we're sitting here today, and we're seeing that these people of faith and conscience, and I have to say, when I heard the story, just big tears rolled down my eyes, are actually there right now, trying to give witness really to what our government is doing to these people in Guantanamo. And it's an outrage, but at the same time, I cannot tell you how I embrace each person right now in Santiago, Cuba. They're doing what millions of Americans ought to be doing. Millions of Americans ought to be out there protesting what our government is doing right now, torturing people, detaining them indefinitely, and disappearing them in secret CIA black holes all over Europe. When I heard that, I understand we're going to have a statement read by Diana Ortiz. And Diana Ortiz was an Ursuline nun who I represented, actually, along with the center, back in the 80s during the Central American Wars. And she was brutally, as many of you probably know, brutally tortured. And when we brought her case into an American court, and the American court was very, very clear. It was a case against the general involved, General Gramajo from Guatemala. Torture can never be used. It has no limitations in terms of its prohibition. It doesn't make any difference who you are or where you are. You can't torture anyone under any conditions. Nor can you use cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, a lesser degree of torture. Our courts were very, very clear on that. And when I see what's going on today and see of course, the U.S. always did some of this sub rosa, but when I see what's going on today, that publicly and openly, the U.S. is essentially putting forth the position that we can torture people, we can disappear people, and we can detain them indefinitely. It's not just as if it's a Chilean dictatorship doing it.
This is supposedly the biggest, most powerful democracy in the world doing it. And what message does that send to the rest of the world?
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Everything is all right. Everything is all wrong. Nobody likes make things go wrong. And now one thing they start, they show mistake. A mistake they start, they show mistake. Mistake they make two kinds. One kind they call them good mistake. The other kind they call them bad mistake. Good mistake you fit repair. Bad mistake they cause disgrace. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, you fit stand like a man. Mistake you go make, people fit laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them go smile again. Mistake you go make, your mind go clear like rain. After all the mistake, you still stand like a man. That being said, everything is alright. That being said, you are right, everything is all. That being said, you are right. That being said, you are right. La la la. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. Mistake you go make, people go laugh at you. After they laugh at you, them keeps laughing at you. Mistake you go make, you go beg some man. Today beg the man because you fear the man. Mistake you go make, you go shame to walk for road. Mistake you go make, you no go fit stand like man. Last day you are black, you know they think like black. That being said, everything is all wrong. That being said, you are wrong. That being said, you are wrong. Now bad mistake. Go lonely, I'm thinking. Still be rethinking. I'm a killing students. So that they fall school. Now bad mistake.